Happy Saturday. It's September 6th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Back to life, Michael. Back to reality. But as always, Airmail is here to take the pain out of daily living. And boy, but first, what a week it's been in the news. Good times. A new report has revealed that the Chinese have likely stolen data from nearly every single American. Hooray! The years-long Salt Tycoon cyber attack, which targeted nearly 80 countries, may have resulted in so much stolen data that it can allow Chinese intelligence services to track targets, including politicians and spies. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader of North Korea, brought his 12-year-old daughter, Kim Ju-ai, on a state visit to China this week. This suggests that she might be next in his line of succession, so consider her officially one to watch. As always, Airmail is the antidote to all of this news, and we've got a great episode of Morning Meeting to take you far away.
Thanks, Ashley. We've got a great show, as you mentioned. If you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and who isn't, you are surely a fan of Susie Essman, who plays Susie Green on the show. And this week, she's going to join us with a rather Curb-like story about her encounter with Prince Andrew. You're going to want to hear this. Then, our colleague James Walcott, perhaps the smartest cultural critic there is, joins us to discuss the return of perhaps the sharpest cultural and social satire going these days. That's the animated show South Park. And finally, it's September, which means the new edition of Airmail Look, our monthly title covering all things beauty and wellness, has landed in your inbox. And Linda Wells is going to be here to tell us everything we need to know. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
We have to start with Susie Essman, Michael, because we need a laugh. We know and love her as Susie Green from Curb Your Enthusiasm. And she's got a great story in the issue this week about her fateful meeting with Prince Andrew of all possible people. Welcome, Susie.
Hi.
Okay, so Susie, Michael and I are among your many, many, many millions, perhaps even billions of fans. And in this particular moment, as we are dealing with life, we just want to, first of all, thank you for your service as a comedian.
Well, thank you for thanking me for my service.
Well, whenever Michael and I are having a particularly bad day, we just watched the last season of Curb, really mostly for your outfits, which are so completely bananas. They put us in a good mood.
You know, it's so much fun to put on those outfits. For me, it's like I always act. Some people act from the inside out. I'm an outside in. So I put on the outfits and then I just become her. I don't have to think about it. But they got crazier and crazier as the years went on. And Larry told me that the last season, he just gave up. He just let us go crazy. And it's, you know, it's because Susie Green is so severely secure. She has no insecurities whatsoever. And she believes that she has the greatest taste.
Well, we need to get into your story in the issue of Airmail this week, which is about Prince Andrew of all possible people. So how exactly did you end up meeting him?
Well, I believe it was 2015. And my friend Matt Schechner, who at the time was running Advertising Week UK, I was in the UK doing the Soho Theater. And he invited me, he did this event at Kensington Palace. And I'm like, well, when am I going to get invited to Kensington? I don't see Will and Kate, you know, having me for tea. So I, of course, went. And it was quite impressive. It's a palace. And, you know, people live there, as you know. I mean, Kate and Will live there. And Diana used to live there. They have what they call apartments. You know, they're like 10,000 square foot apartments, not like my little place. I went, and just out of curiosity, because I was there, and it was this incredible room with just these oil paintings everywhere. On the ceiling were murals, and it was just like these Renaissance paintings everywhere you looked. And you know, that was the crappy ones, because this was a reception room that, like, you know, they didn't live in. So they saved the Michelangelos and the Leonardos for themselves. This, I don't know who the hell it was. But Prince Andrew was there. And clearly he was paid to be there as some kind of, I don't know what, liaison of royalty. And that's how I met him.
Yeah. So did he have any idea who you were? I mean, is he a fan of yours?
No idea whatsoever. Matt introduced me, telling him what show I'm on HBO and et cetera. And he was like, well, I have no idea who you are. You know, it's just very, I have no idea who you are. I don't watch any television. And, you know, he was very, very pompous and very much an asshole. I mean, I'm not offended if nobody watches the show. Not everybody watches the show. So I wasn't basically, but it was the way he said it. You know, he was just so dismissive. You know, dismissive of just a television actress. Who the hell am I? You know, I'm not royalty.
I'm honestly, the fact that he's not seen Curbed is really his loss. But anyway, we'd expect nothing less. But then he goes on to be even more absurd and insulting.
Well, I had nothing to say to him. He was impossible to make small talk with, which you would think that the royal family would be well versed in that kind of chit chat, because they don't talk about anything substantive to, you know, regular folk like us. So I just said, well, do you live here? And he said, no, I don't live here. Nobody lives here. We use this part of the palace to rent out. So I said, oh, that's smart. And then he said, and I will never forget it, out of nowhere, it was not prompted, we have a Jew who runs our finances. We have a Jew who runs our finances. And my husband was standing right next to me and he heard it too. And it was just like, I don't even know how to respond to that. Like, why did he even say it?
I mean, Susie, this guy clearly has no manners and doesn't know how to make conversation, but you obviously do. How did you even respond? How did you get out of the situation?
Well, I was shocked. And, you know, when I'm on stage, I'm incredibly quick. But when I'm in real life, my brain just doesn't work that way. I'm not in the zone. So when people insult me, I mean, I don't know that he was insulting me. He didn't necessarily know I was Jewish. But when people insult me, I never have a quick comeback. People always think I will because I could do it on stage so facilely. But I'm always shocked when people assault me verbally. You know, I'm always taken aback. So I just said to him, well, isn't that clever of you? And just turned around and walked away. You know, and the other thing about it is that the tone deafness of him is just remarkable. To say that to anybody, whether I was Jewish or Christian or Catholic or Muslim or whatever I was, just to use that and he didn't say, we have a Jewish person or we have a Jewish firm. We have a Jew.
I mean, it almost seems like a weird Tourette's-y type of, you know, just like something that just popped into his head that he felt the need to get out for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Just in his quasi-context, we've since learned one of his very good friends was a Jew, Jeffrey Epstein, who may have been doing his finances as well. So maybe he just is, you know, but I would love to know how that relationship went. Just interjecting that, can carry on.
At the time, I was not aware of that relationship. Later on, I thought of that. Was that the Jew? Was it the infamous Jeffrey Epstein Jew who was running his finance? But he said our finances, which is literally the royal we. So that didn't make sense to me, but who knows? Who knows? Because, you know, he's the queen's favorite. She's dead, but he was the queen's favorite, which, you know, in and of itself makes you suspect of her judgment.
You know, the queen's favorite is just a fancy way of saying you're a mama's boy.
Yes. And Charles clearly was not. I watched The Crown. I actually felt sorry for him after watching The Crown. And I think he's kind of hard to feel sorry for. But the whole royalty thing, you know, this whole concept of you have to curtsy. We don't get that as Americans. It just doesn't make, why do I have to curtsy to these people? Who the hell are they?
Oh, you don't know that? Trump just signed an executive order and you now have to curtsy to him and Melania. The news is moving fast here, but just so it's changed here.
Well, but he's a perfect example of that. We don't get that here. You're supposed to just revere people for no reason because of their birth. That's so undemocratic. Well, I mean, am I supposed to curtsy to Princess Michael of Kent? Who the fuck is she?
Probably not.
I bow down to Larry David. That's about it. And even him, I don't.
You know what? I'll curtsy to Larry David any day of the week. I'll curtsy to you. Anyone on that show. Any of the writers, the producers, that's who Michael and I are going to bow and curtsy to. Those are our royals.
You know what? I'm glad it happened because I wasn't terribly insulted because he was such a pompous idiot. And it's been a great story to dine out on all these years. Not everyone has a really good anti-Semitic Prince Andrew story.
That is one of your many virtues, Susie. It's all yours. Susie, what else are you working on? When can we see you next on television or in film?
I start shooting in October, a show with Larry that the Obamas are producing, which is for the 250th anniversary of our country, which hopefully we still exist next July 4th. And it's historical sketches a la Larry's history. And I don't think I could tell you the character that I play, but it'll be a lot of fun. We'll be back together again. And it'll be the same relationship.
Please, God, let her wear caftans.
No, this character is this historical character who existed pre-caftan. Although, I don't know, caftans probably existed, you know, in the Arab world forever.
Mary Todd Lincoln, big caftan fan. I don't know if you know that.
Big caftan.
Well, Susie, thank you so much. We love your story. We love your comedy and we love you. So we can't wait to see your new show and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk soon.
So speaking of the comedy that we need in these deeply troubled times, our columnist James Wolcott is here to talk about South Park, which is the show that has been on the air for 27 years, and yet people are talking about it more than ever. Jim is the author of several books, including the memoir, Lucking Out, My Life, Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York, a must read. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
So, Jim, you know, this is going to shock you, but I am not a regular watcher of South Park. And after reading your review of the new season this week, it made me realize that I'm really missing out on something special. The show has been around for a very long time. Before we get into this season, can you just give us a brief overview of how it started and why it endures?
Well, it's the work of two guys. It was all sort of slapped together. I mean, they were originally working with very low budget, low-tech comedy, but the first couple episodes, I think, were like a Christmas pageant. But the thing that grabbed everybody was you had all these little kids cursing like crazy, just rattling off obscenities. And it was sort of like it took Beavis and Butthead to an even younger degree. And it was about the school and the relationship of these four kids and, you know, what goes on at the school and all that. But they built it up into like a larger satire. But the larger satire never lost touch, never disconnected from the sheer, you know, raunchiness and the novelty of having all these kids say all these horrible things, and also very, you know, politically incorrect things back when that phrase was more in vogue. But it was like, well, you couldn't get really mad at the kids saying it because they're just like popping off. The thing was, the show was very smart because it never tried to overscale. It works on a very short deadline. They just sort of write the script very fast, so it's not. The nature of the animation is that you don't have to have all this post-production. And so they could keep up with things happening in the culture. I mean, I was sort of stunned to realize that the show began when Bill Clinton was president. So, I mean, that's how far, that's the political arc that they have followed. And they've had, you know, all sorts of controversies along the way with the uses of racial slang. But the spirit of the show makes it very hard for people to get indignant about it. It's sort of like getting indignant at Beavis and Butthead. I mean, it would just be, well, come on.
Jim, as you, like so many satirists, it seems like South Park is one of those shows that really shines in moments of controversy and upheaval culturally. How do we find them in this second moment of the Trump administration?
They've gone beyond what anybody might have anticipated because, you know, it's when you think about how much Trump has been satirized, I mean, everybody's had their turn at it. But what they've done is they've made him both more infantile and at the same time more destructive. He's the Trump is sort of pure appetite, but they've literally diminished him. In real life, Trump is a tall guy, you know, and he likes to lean over people and do all that. They've shrunk him down to the size of, he's not as small as the school kids, but he's fairly small. And he talks like this. He's got, you know, he's all appetite. And it's like, oh, I want a present. I want this. I want that. And then this relentless focus in one episode on Trump's alleged tiny penis, or as I call it in the piece, is Wee Willie Winky. So you have one character after another, one White House official saying, don't mention a small penis. And then other people saying, and I personally do not believe that you have a small penis. And so it just goes on and on in the repetition. And with that, we also have him literally in bed with Satan. Last night, the big news was that Trump had impregnated Satan. And I'm not sure how that works, you know, biologically, theologically, metaphysically. That's the path that the show is now going on for the remaining episodes of this season.
It's very heartening, Jim, because so many critics of Trump and his administration, I mean, at least some of them are starting to get a bit scared, you know, given how retaliatory Trump can be and how merciless he can be when it comes to his critics. But it seems like these two are really just leaning into their role in the culture right now.
Well, they're not only leaning into their role, but they're really ripping on the parent company because they signed a $1.5 billion deal with Paramount Plus. You know, and Paramount has gone through this whole thing with Skydance and the, you know, merger and consolidation. So South Park was ripping Paramount and ripping them for, you know, their cowardice, their capitulation to Trump in order to get the merger approved. And so they could have just taken the money and been a little cheeky, but they've taken the money and been vicious, which is, you know, sort of heartening. Most entertainers would just, you know, they would just needle a little bit, but they wouldn't push the blade all the way through.
Jim, one of the lines you have in your story, your column this week, which I think is so good, you know, you say the best, meanest satire doesn't hold back, especially when there's a monster on a loose. And I think, you know, as Ashley sort of noted at the beginning of the conversation, satire is an overused phrase and people always don't know what it means. Why are these guys so good at it? Because to me, like, they're right in line there with the best political cartoonists and the best political satirists, right?
Parker and Stone, I think part of it is they just have a dynamic. It's like there's something about two guys, or it can be two guys or two women or two, you know, guy. But there's something about a team working together, throwing things back and forth and trying out crazy things on each other. I think that sort of rhythm, that sort of dynamic can like make them bolder than if one person is a satirist and they're constantly worried about, well, is this going to happen to me? Are they going to pull the plug on this? Are they going to do that? These two guys, I mean, they, as I mentioned in the piece, they did a smash Broadway musical that's still running. It had tremendous shock effect when it opened, and yet here it is. It's still, you know, it's still there. They keep rotating new missionaries in for the musical. So I think that's part of it. And I would draw a parallel to what's happened, like with the Coen brothers, who worked so well together, but now that they're working separately, the two of them needed each other. You know, there is something about partnership that can really like take things to another level.
Yeah, I kind of see these guys. It's, I mean, as a reminder, they go back to the Clinton years, but I still feel like the brilliance of two guys basically sitting in their dorm room trying to outdo each other and building it together. And that sort of spirit is still there, but with a great intelligence as its bedrock, you know?
It's smart, but they also don't overthink it. They have that kind of brilliantly dumb thing going on that, you know, Beavis and Butthead did, you know, the Ramones did. I mean, some other punker once said of the Ramones, they invade a stupid part of your brain where you're totally defenseless. There are songs. And so, and I do think there's something about that with South Park. You know, one difference between South Park and The Simpsons is historians of the Simpsons will say things like, well, you know, see, up to season 5, it was great. And then seasons fell off, and then seasons 8 to 12 were fantastic. But no one ever says that about South Park. South Park just sort of bounces along on the same, because it is the same two guys. You're not rotating in new writers or anything like that. So the sensibility is the same. And
it sounds like it's great television for the TikTok age. You know, it's that reactive and that responsive.
Yeah, you can reduce things to clips. I mean, you can really, you know, they're not doing extended sequences that require, you know, buildup. It can be just, you know, a 10-second wisecrack from one of the kids. You know that these guys are not prone to, like, whatever the consensus is about anything. The consensus for them is whatever the two of them cook up.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, all of this is just feeling like it's a bit too much. Let's bring on Linda Wells. She's the editor at Airmail Look. She was the founding editor of Allure magazine, which was a position she held for 25 years. And she knows all of the latest news we definitely need to use from the worlds of beauty and wellness. It's a new issue of Airmail Look, and Linda will take us through. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, Ashley and Michael.
So this is always a difficult week as we are mentally and physically back to reality, but the new issue of Airmail Look still gives us lots of reasons to relish being here, as well as a hearty dose of escapism. So let's first talk about your amazing column this week, The Look From Here. It's all about a new type of skincare that everyone is talking about.
Yes, the sexiest word in skincare right now is plasma.
I feel like Stefan on SNL. It actually is very Stefan too. It comes from platelet-rich plasma, which a lot of people have heard about. That's when your blood is drawn, it's spun in a centrifuge, and they separate the plasma and then apply it to your lasered or microneedled skin. And that has to happen in a kind of medical setting. So, and I'm sure you've heard about Brian Johnson, the tech entrepreneur and longevity nut who recently held a bag of his own plasma in his hands and said he wished he could give it to all the people of the world. So we also have Barbara Sturm, who was notorious for meeting with beauty editors at the beginning of her skincare brand's life. And she'd meet with them in five-star hotels, take their blood, extract it, then spin it, and then mix it with a cream and send them on their way. So now all sorts of skincare products that you'd find at Nordstrom or Sephora have plasma in their name. And they're really doing well. These are really popular brands. Dr. Diamonds, Medicine, 8th Day, You Beauty. These are really the hottest brands, but they don't actually contain any plasma. So it's marketing. And in some cases, they're piggybacking on the consumer's vague knowledge about plasma being good for the skin. And they're connecting with this idea of platelet-rich plasma, which does do something for the skin. But they just are really kind of giving you a sense of science and performance. And what they're actually delivering is something that's very cushiony and moisturizing and may help the skin heal itself in some ways. So watch out for plasma.
I mean, Linda, you had this done, right? Like you had one of these microneedling facials with PRP. What was your experience like?
So yes, I went to meet with Dr. Diamond and he was at a house in East Hampton and I lay on a stranger's bed and had my face numbed and then, thank God. And then they took a little microneedle. Of course, my eyes were closed, so I wasn't looking at the machine itself, but it was like a stamp and stamped my skin all over with these needles, which doesn't feel terrific. And then they put my own plasma on it. They took a lot of blood, spun it, and it was kind of disgusting, but I mean, it's a legitimate treatment, but I can't say it really did anything for me, but that's the way I feel about a lot of things. They don't always like make a dramatic before and after, but it's a phenomenon. And actually, these products are really good. The fact that they don't contain plasma isn't a reason to hate them. They actually do contain other interesting ingredients that are supposed to really help the skin repair itself. And that's what anti-aging products are all about. Even though we don't like the term anti-aging, aging is considered a wound to skin, and the way to repair it is with some of these ingredients.
Linda, we also have another story from the writer Chelsea Frank that proposes a different way to optimize your glow, so to speak. She profiles a woman that I guess we're calling the orgasm whisperer. What did we learn?
We learned that there is a woman who believes that if you lift cantaloupes and other objects with your vaginal muscles, you will strengthen those vaginal muscles, which in turn will give you exceptional orgasms, which in turn will improve your skin. And it's all a crazy bit of nonsense, but it's certainly entertaining. She does this with a jade egg and a string, and then these various objects are dangled between her legs, and she has appeared in various spots with a chandelier, for instance, or all sorts of other things. And it's a stunt, but the notion is that this is like Kegels on steroids, so to speak, and believes that this is nature's beauty treatment. And she wants people to have G-spot orgasms, and that will really be the key to never needing a facelift. But this all sounds kind of bizarre, but also intriguing. But don't tell a gynecologist that, because we talked to some and they were like, no, you do not want to do this. These muscles are not meant to carry that kind of a load. And we can go into all sorts of puns, but we're above that. They say, just do your Kegels and have a happy life and don't be crazy.
So Linda, our cosmetic chemist, Javon Ford, who writes the Hype Buster column for us, has tackled the Yuka app this month. And this is something we've been hearing a lot about, not only because many of our friends use it and have been talking about it to us, but also because RFK is a big fan, apparently, and he's been suggesting that we use this as a way of vetting the products that we use for quote-unquote toxic components. What did we learn?
Yeah, with RFK's endorsement, you want to sort of stand back and take a deep breath. But he's really endorsing it for that food aspect of the Yuka app. The Yuka app is you basically scan the barcode of food or beauty products, and it could be home, you know, it could be like mouthwashes and toothpaste and things like that, as well as beauty products. And then it will give you a rating or a score based on the ingredients in the product. So if it contains something that is, studies say, that might have danger or might have endocrine disruptors or might be, you know, suspected of being carcinogenic, it will get a bad rating or a zero. And this is an independent app. It's not supported by anybody. And it's based on scientific studies. It comes out of France. And it seems like, what a great tool. How fantastic. When you're in the store, you can just point it at a bunch of things and find out what's going on. But it really can oversimplify things. And it doesn't really take into account the concentration of an ingredient that might be questionable. And it also, it all tends to rate organic products as superior than non-organic. And in beauty, there's no proof that an organic product is better than a synthetic one or a chemical one. So that doesn't really hold up so well in the beauty world. So it's helpful for finding ingredient lists, because if you've ever tried to read an ingredient list on a beauty product, they're microscopic. It's helpful for that. And if you have allergies, it can be really a great way to find out if there's an allergen in your product. So it's got a lot of use to it.
Linda and Ashley, I'm going to change the subject here for a second. We found out just before we were going to speak with you that one of the great titans of fashion and style just passed, Mr. Armani, Giorgio Armani in Milan today. And I just want to take a minute to just get your thoughts about him and the decades he was in our lives.
Yeah, Giorgio Armani put Italian fashion on the map. He really was the reason that you went to Milan for many of the years, particularly in the 90s, when I started covering the fashion shows in the early 90s. It was the pinnacle of Milan fashion. It was also a great sign of success. If you made it, you would go straight out and buy an Armani suit. And I remember I did exactly that when I was made editor of Allure. I went straight to the Armani store and bought myself an Armani suit. And men wore them. Richard Gere was, you know, the Armani king in American Gigolo. So he really created so many things. He created this idea of a relaxed suit of workwear for men and women that was different and kind of cooler. And he elevated fabrics. And then he, you know, took everything to a different level with his Armani Privé, the couture collection, where it was really, I mean, this explosion of creativity. And he did it. And he was the man there all the time creating these shows. It wasn't, he wasn't outsourcing it or delegating it. He was the one and only, and took that bow at the end of the runway. So it's a huge loss for someone who really defined Italian fashion for so many decades. And the great moment was when you would go to Milan and you'd go to the Armani dinner, and it was at his house, and the show was at his house. Eventually he, you know, outgrew that and moved it to a Tato Ando theater where he had his shows. But it was just, he was the first person to get celebrities to go to the shows. So, you know, I sat next to 50 Cent one time, and, you know, Sylvester Stallone tried to take my seat at a dinner party, and Janet Jackson was there. It was always just full of fun and a real level of excellence.
Yeah, I think his impact on, you know, we look across and like, it's Mr. Armani, it's Ralph Lauren, these people who sort of shaped the last 30, 40, 50 years of fashion style. And as you know, like, he invented celebrity dressing on the red carpet at the Oscars, really, pretty much, and, you know, redefined the silhouette for men and women in a time very few people have even matched that. So, and his reach is extraordinary and his impact on the culture. So definitely going to be a major loss. And as we were saying beforehand, like, not even clear what the succession plan is there.
I know there was no discussion of who was going to be next. So that's going to be an interesting, what's going to happen next is going to be really interesting. There was a time when he was so concerned with what journalists thought of the show that he put microphones on the seats to try to hear the comments. And then he videotaped the front row And then he would have a lip reader do the comments. And people would get calls the next day and say, what did you think of the show? You know, he ruled fashion. He really ruled fashion in Milan. And he gave a lot of people a lot of beauty and inspiration, and he'll be really missed.
People forget, Milan as a fashion center didn't really exist until his show was hit in the late 70s. Before then, it was all either Florence or maybe a little bit of Rome, but this idea of Milan competing with Paris as a fashion capital really owes it to Mr. Armani.
Yeah, and I think that people always would say that Milan was more the business of fashion and Paris was the creativity of fashion, but he really married business and fashion in a very elegant and aspirational way that made workwear feel very stylish and very desirable. I mean, he really gave Hollywood executives their look.
Well, Linda, thanks so much. Another issue of Look is in your inboxes, and thank you for your also unique and beautiful insights on the legacy of Mr. Armani.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ashley. We'll talk soon.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. Airmail's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, Airmail Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, it is the weekend. What do you got?
You know, I've got something good. I was reminded the other day, thanks to Film Form, you know, that indispensable revival theater that I know you're a huge fan of, Ashley, here in New York City, that this year is the centenary of one of cinema's greatest comedic talents, Peter Sellers. And if you live here in New York, Film Form, I realized, is going to be hosting 2 weeks of Sellers' greatest films. And I thought, you know, whether you live here or don't live here, if you don't live here, I'd suggest you go to their website and use it as an opportunity to sort of program your own film festival at home, which I might do, sort of mix of going there and also doing some at home. They, I was just looking through the other day. Actually, they've got one of my favorites, which is The Lady Killers, which is one of his early films, and I think maybe his funniest, in which he co-stars with Alec Guinness and a few other guys, and it's a great one. I think it's classic comedy. But you also have Casino Royale, Dr. Strangelove, and Being There. Anyway, listening to Jim, and we need some more comedy, but like I say, I think he's one of the great comedic actors. So I think it's like, take a chance to see a genius at work and have some wonderful laughs over these next couple of weeks. It's Peter Sellers. And you can't continue, my dear?
Definitely not. Well, I've got something slightly more lowbrow for you, but have you seen this great show Hostage on Netflix? It just came out a couple weeks ago.
No, I don't know anything about it.
Oh my God. Well, it's a political thriller. It was written by this guy, Matt Charman, and it stars Saran Jones as a Liz Truss-like prime minister of the UK, as well as Julie Delpy, a Marine Le Pen-esque president of France, and the drama that ensues when the UK prime minister's husband goes missing and is taken hostage. So without giving away too many spoilers, I mean, is this Orson Welles? It is not. No, but it is. Is this Vince Gilligan? It is not. But it is just a soapy drama that will usher you into fall on a cloud of suspense, which is exactly what we need right now. Oh, and I also have a book to recommend on a totally different note. It's called Love from Venice, A Golden Summer on the Grand Canal. And this is a really bizarre book. So a young woman in the summer of 1957 moved from London to Venice, and she was 25 years old and sort of trying to figure out the next thing in her career. And she ended up as a summer nanny to the Brandolini Dada family. It was quite amazing. And she's, I believe, 90 years old now, and she published this book last year. It was her first ever book. It is a fabulous memoir. And it's really a love letter to Venice, especially at this particular period. It was sort of the end of the Grand Tour, before mass tourism had invaded the city, in the upper echelons of the aristocracy. And she takes us inside that world, and it's completely fascinating. I was visiting a friend in Venice last weekend over Labor Day weekend, and she had it at her house and she gave it to me as I was going to the airport. And she was like, oh, you should read this. And I mean, I just devoured it on the plane and I had finished it basically by the time I went to bed. So anyway, it's a really fun read. If you want to recapture some summer romance and love, it's called Love from Venice, A Golden Summer on the Grand Canal. And the author is Gil Johnson.
Fantastic.
Well, we wish you all a wonderful weekend. We thank you so, so much for joining us. Mike, will you please read us out?
For sure. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our coders are Graydon Carter and Alison Stanley. Our chief operating officers, Bill Keenan. Our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. But in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again.